Well, thank you so much, everyone, for coming to a talk on this subject, which I personally find a very difficult subject. How can a loving God allow so much suffering? Perhaps we are asking this question because for many of us, the fact of suffering makes us reluctant to trust the God of the Bible. In a nutshell, I think our question is, surely if God is all good, he would want to prevent suffering. And if he's all powerful, he'd be able to stop suffering. So seeing as suffering exists, how can an all-powerful, all-loving God exist? 3 years ago, I faced the hardest situation that I have ever had to deal with. Now, don't get me wrong, I have had an easy life. However, the period of suffering that myself and my wife went through was harder than everything else in my life put together. I've been struggling with this question for years, but particularly since March 2010, I've been asking, how can a loving God allow suffering? I'd like to look at four perspectives on suffering. Firstly, free will. Why does God allow suffering? Well, of course, the question presupposes that God exists. What do we think this God should do? Perhaps we think he should have gone for option A and created nothing at all. This is, of course, the ultimate low-risk option. No suffering, no one gets hurt. Or perhaps we think he should have gone for option B and made robotic people who are just lifeless machines. There's no feeling, there's no pleasure, there's no pain, there's just metal. This is another no-risk option. God chooses, however, to go for option C, an extremely high-risk alternative. In option C, God creates highly intelligent, spiritual beings like himself, free agents who can make real choices just like he can. But the moment he gives them true freedom, he risks the possibility that they might choose to reject him. Now, why on earth would God choose option C? We wouldn't expect him to, because he risks a world of pain if people rebel against him and each other. Why does he take the risk? What is to be gained by having free will? The answer is genuine love. There is a direct link between free will and love. I discovered this for myself in the summer of 1995 when I fell in love with a marine biologist called Julia Brown. The whole thrill of it was that she chose to love me back. She could very easily have chosen not to. She could have chosen someone else, but she didn't. She chose me. And that's why it was exciting. Robots can't fall in love. All we are saying is that if God is powerful enough to stop suffering, and then he chooses not to, presumably there must be a reason. There must be a reason why, at least in his opinion, it is worth allowing suffering. His reason is that he is love, and he wants, therefore, there to be real love in the world. And because he wants real love, it means he's got to give us freedom of choice. Now, here, someone should quite rightly object and say, hang on, if God is still all-powerful, he could still jump in and prevent tragedies like car accidents. But if God jumped in to prevent every accident, then everybody presumably would drive as fast as possible down the middle of the road in the certain knowledge of never hitting anything. So we've got to at least think through the consequences of what it is that we are asking God to do. Every time God steps in so that real choices don't have consequences, he reduces our freedom until he'll end up having to jump in every other minute, and then we're reduced to being robots all over again with no free will at all. But we still feel that this answer, which you are hearing at the moment, we all feel this isn't good enough. And there's a number of reasons why this answer that I'm giving you isn't good enough. Firstly, because we're still hurting. Hey, I'm not so stupid as to think that anything I say today will take away the pain. Second reason why this answer I'm giving you isn't good enough is because we still want a world without suffering. But surely we're not saying that the only deal we're prepared to accept from God is a world where we can enjoy total freedom to do anything we want, but with no possibility of anyone ever suffering the consequences. Because that would be like holding a gun to God's head saying, God, the only thing you could ever do to stop me from pulling the trigger right now would be to create a round square. Not even God can create a round square. Not even God can create a world where we enjoy real freedom, but never suffer any of the consequences of our actions. So much suffering is the result of human choice. We read about famine in Africa, and then we turn the page and discover there's enough corn in the American state of Nebraska to feed every starving child in Africa. We read about violent crimes, murders, and atrocities. All these things are the result of human choice. And so if you accept that God has given people free will, well, it does make it easier to understand how human evil follows. Yeah, but we're still hurting. What is even harder to talk about are natural disasters. An event like, for example, the 2004 Boxing Day tsunami in Southeast Asia. Here, an earthquake was to blame. Now, I would not say what I'm about to say to anyone who's struggling emotionally with earthquakes. But if you or I were sent the short distance to the library right now, and we were sat down and we had to write an academic report on why that tsunami happened, the bottom line is that the 2004 Boxing Day tsunami happened because our planet is made up of absolutely huge tectonic plates which grate against each other. But on the other hand, if it weren't for tectonic plates, none of us would be here. We would still have a water world. Without plate tectonics, the continents that we live on would never have formed. Now, I know that we all know this, but inside our Earth, we've got all this hot molten metal in the form of nickel and iron. That is what makes the Earth magnetic. And it's that magnetism that creates and regulates the Earth's atmosphere, and it's the Earth's atmosphere being just as it is in relation to the Earth's magnetism. That balance is the thing that enables advanced organic life to continue on the surface of our planet. But then the metal in the center of the Earth is a problem because it's so hot it has to be released somehow, and the release mechanism that enables human life to exist on the surface of our planet is earthquakes. So earthquakes, it turns out, regulate these three competing forces, and it's earthquakes that enable human life to carry on the surface of our planet. Scientists tell us you can't have human life on our planet without earthquakes. Or, as astronomer Dr. Hugh Ross of Toronto University puts it, if we do find advanced life on the surface of other planets, scientists predict that planet will have plate tectonics. Secondly, it turns out that plate tectonics are crucial to the preservation of life on Earth because they bury material. It's plate tectonics that removes the carbon dioxide and water from the atmosphere, and that compensates for a massive problem that we have, the increasing luminosity of the sun, the fact the sun's getting brighter and brighter. Thirdly, it turns out that the level of earthquake activity is finely tuned. It turns out that fewer or more earthquakes would throw the whole balance of our planet off course. Yeah, maybe. But we still wonder, hey, couldn't God have done something to warn those people that the tidal wave was coming? Well, in this particular case, the technology was available. There was already a tsunami warning system in place off the west coast of the USA. The world's richest nations could have given one to the Southeast Asian nations. But hey, look, as I'm sure we can all tell, there's no getting away from it. There's no escape from it. Natural disasters are appalling. They just leave us crying out, why? anyone who's not deeply moved by the scenes that we see on our TV news must have a heart of stone. A second perspective on suffering is that God sometimes works through suffering to bring about good. At school, I had a maths teacher called Mr. Rosser, and he used to say, having listened to my various complaints, he used to say to me, "Holloway, life's tough, rough, and desperately unjust." But for some reason, people think the Bible teaches the opposite. People think the Bible promises sweetness and light. It doesn't. C.S. Lewis said that pain is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. Numerous people become Christians as a result of suffering. Now, clearly, in those circumstances, from their point of view, the pain is worth the gain. In their opinion, 70 years of suffering is outweighed by an eternity in paradise. Second, another aspect here is that it brings us to maturity. What do I mean? Well, let's imagine that God decided to keep all teenagers in the world indoors on a Friday night because God wanted to protect them from the pain of hangovers and broken hearts. If he did, there would be a global riot because all over the world people are grateful for the freedom to go out at the weekend. Perhaps equal doses of freedom and suffering are needed to bring us to a place of maturity where we can enjoy life to the full. It is interesting and surprising to me that most Christians seem to have their faith strengthened by suffering. If the fact of suffering was such a knockout argument that it actually disproves the existence of the Christian God, I've always wondered, why don't more Christians quit? Why does suffering seem to have the opposite effect? Next, Christians are so often the driving force in aid agencies which are fighting to relieve suffering around the world, as even a casual glance through the history books will show. Next, we won't always see what God is up to. Let me give you an example from my childhood. When I was a child, I genuinely thought that the dentist was a torture chamber. It was all face masks and needles. I was forced to go in there against my will. Then a man in a white coat drilled into me. It seemed to me that the more I screamed, the more that he was enjoying it. As far as I was concerned, he was attacking me. I had no idea that the pain was worth the gain because I had a child's perspective. What if we're like that child, and at least sometimes God is like the dentist? For all we know, a loving God might allow at least some suffering because actually he is doing us a favor. I think my life's been like that. There have been times when I've looked back on painful episodes and realized actually, yes, something good did come out of that. A third perspective, and of course, please do ask questions about all of this, but a third perspective is that God is not immune from suffering. Hey, I wouldn't want anyone here this lunchtime to get the impression that the Christians are trying to get God off the hook for suffering, because the fact is God has put himself on the hook. God has put himself on the cross. Have you ever heard the poem, The Long Silence? It goes like this. At the end of time, billions of people were scattered on a great plain before God's throne. Most shrank back from the brilliant light before them, but some groups near the front talked heatedly, not with cringing shame, but with belligerence. "Can God judge us? How can he know about suffering?" snapped a young girl, and she ripped open her sleeve to reveal a tattooed number from a Nazi concentration camp. "We endured terror, beatings, torture, and death," she said. In another group, a young man lowered his collar. "What about this?" he demanded. "Lynched for no crime but being black," he said. In another crowd, a pregnant schoolgirl with sullen eyes. "Why should I suffer?" she murmured. "Wasn't my fault." Far out across the plain, there were hundreds of such groups. Each had a complaint against God for the evil and suffering that he had allowed in his world. How lucky God was to live in heaven where all was sweetness and light, where there was no weeping or fear or hunger or hatred. What did God know of all that man had been forced to endure in the world? For God leads a pretty sheltered life, they said. So each of these groups sent forth their leader, chosen because he or she had suffered most. A Jew, someone from Hiroshima, a deformed arthritic, a thalidomide child. And in the center of the plain, they consulted together, and at last they were ready to present their case. Before God could be qualified to be their judge, he must endure what they had endured. Their decision was that God should be sentenced to live on earth as a man. Let him be born a Jew, they said. Let the legitimacy of his birth be doubted, they said. Give him a work to do that when he tries to do it, even his family will think that he's out of his mind, they said. Let him then be betrayed by his closest friends, they said. Let him face false charges. Let him be tried by a prejudiced jury. Let him then be convicted by a cowardly judge, they said. Then let him be tortured, let him be flogged, let him be scourged with a whip, mocked, spat at, they said. Then let him be totally alone. Let him be deserted, and then in extreme agony, let him die, they said. As each leader announced his portion of the sentence, loud murmurs of approval went up from the throng of people assembled. And when the last had finished pronouncing sentence, there was a long silence. No one uttered another word. No one moved. For suddenly, all knew that God had already served his sentence. The Christian answer to suffering is a person. It's not really an answer as such. It's Jesus. Sometimes words aren't enough. Hey, if I am suffering, coming in here and listening to a 20-minute talk is not what I'm looking for, because I've got a personal problem, therefore I need a personal answer. But as it happens, God is a someone and not a something. In that sense, when we do think of the worst moments of our lives, Jesus has been there. Are you broken? Jesus was broken on the cross. Are you rejected by your friends? Jesus was rejected by his friends. Are you hated for no good reason? Jesus was hated for no good reason. When we cry out and we complain that we can't take it anymore, we can think of Jesus on the cross saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus is more than an explanation. Jesus is a person. And hey, if while I'm in Durham this lunchtime, I get a phone call to say that my wife and four kids have just died in a car crash in London, I don't know if I'll ever get in this life an adequate explanation for what happened. But I do believe that God has left me with something more satisfying than an explanation. God has left me with Jesus. Maybe you're here today. When all is said and done, something evil has happened to you. I know that nothing that I say today will take away the pain. It is also true that something evil happened on a hill outside Jerusalem in about 30 AD when an innocent man called Jesus was murdered. And actually on every chair, there is, amazingly enough, an eyewitness account of what happened that day. If you'd like to, you can turn to page 54, either now or later, and you can read an eyewitness account of what happened. But God brought something beautiful out of that tragedy. God allowed the suffering of his own son because he knew that through it something wonderful could be achieved. At the time, Jesus' disciples thought this was a disaster. Their hero was being executed. All their hopes and dreams were in tatters. They had no idea that through dying on the cross, Jesus was actually solving the biggest problem they had, the biggest problem that I have, the fact that I have chosen to go my own way, to turn away, to live putting myself first, pushing God to the margins, the problem of sin. Lastly, and very briefly, God more than compensates for our suffering. Can any of us really begin to imagine what 70 billion years of ecstasy might be like? Where we would live every day in a place that's better than the one before, better every day in a place that's better every day. Anyway, those are four perspectives on suffering. And at the end of this talk, somebody says, Adrian, thanks, but it's just not good enough. I know. I agree. It's not good enough. But it seems to me that at the cross of Christ, we can see why a God of love could allow suffering. Because firstly, we see the results of human freedom. If you were to read pages 50 to 53, you'd see a long list of meetings and decisions from a group called the Sanhedrin, these blokes who decide to get Jesus killed. Then they deny Jesus a fair trial. Then there's this man called Pontius Pilate who has Jesus flogged for no particular reason. Then he kills him, again for not a very good reason. We see the results of human freedom in that evil decision. Secondly, we see God working through suffering. You see, when Jesus was dying, and you can read the account on page 55 of his final moments, God seemed to have deserted Jesus. But actually, everything that happened on that day, the day that Jesus died, was planned by God centuries before. You see, in the Old Testament, this series of books that were all finished 400 years before Jesus was born, it was predicted that, firstly, the Messiah would be betrayed by a friend. That's in a book called Psalms 41, verse 9. That's what happened when Judas betrayed Christ. That the Messiah would be struck and spat upon. That was predicted 700 years before the event in Isaiah 50 and verse 6. It was predicted what would happen to the money that was used to betray Jesus. This is Zechariah chapter 11, verses 12 and 13. It was even predicted what would happen to the 30 pieces of silver, that they'd be thrown into a potter's field. And then in Psalm 22, verse 17, it was even predicted what would happen at the foot of the cross to the Messiah's clothes as Jesus was being killed. You can read that at the very bottom of page 54. Even that was predicted. Now, my point is this. The suffering was real as Jesus died on the cross. The injustice was real, but it was all planned. At least 400 years before. In fact, Jesus fulfilled 29 Old Testament prophecies on the day that he died. So clearly, on that day at least, God was working through suffering. Thirdly, on the cross, we see that God is not immune from suffering. He suffered too. And as I close, I want to encourage you, I think this is the most helpful thing of all. If Christianity is true, the God who really exists can relate to what I'm going through. I think I can respect a God who saw the drama of human suffering going on and decided to jump in and suffer too. And then lastly on the cross, we see that God more than compensates for our suffering. Could it be that one day, from your vantage point in heaven, that you will look back and say, actually, now I'm here in heaven, it was all worth it? Could it be from one day you'll look back through the tears and the pain and the relationship breakups, the physical pain, and from your place in heaven, you'll say, yeah, I suppose it's true. God has more than compensated for my suffering. So in conclusion, we don't have a God who just folds his arms and looks down impassively at human suffering. We have a God who saw how bad it was and decided to dive in and suffer with us. We have a suffering God. And halfway down this book, on page 55, we have a crucified God. You have been very patient listening to me on this very difficult subject. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, we're going to make a start with our questions. Number one. If God allows suffering for whatever reason, why should we buy into Christianity? I'd rather forego my ticket to heaven to show God that I'm not happy with his conduct.
Well, the beauty of the fact that God does show respect for human dignity is that ultimately he does respect our choices. So if somebody decides during their 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, they really don't want to have anything to do with this Christian God who allows suffering, then God respects that decision, and that person won't be compelled or forced at some subsequent point to buy into Christianity. So I think probably the answer to that question is we'd have to accept Christianity on other grounds. There'd have to be other reasons why we think Christianity is worth investigating and worth pursuing.
What is the relationship between sin and suffering?
Well, I'll give a brief answer on this. It's a great question. The relationship between sin and suffering is that in some senses, this world is not how God would have liked it to have been. And although we were created to have a relationship with God, when we choose to go our own way, of course, there are consequences. And so, for example, sometimes we might choose a certain course of life, and as a result, we might become sick or ill as a result of something we've eaten or so on and so forth. Sin's a bit like that. And the wonder of it is that although we are free to make our own decisions, God has provided a way whereby we can be forgiven. Now, his way, as I've explained, by coming humanly in the form of Christ, dying on the cross, taking the punishment for the sins of everyone who would ever trust in Christ. Jesus takes those sins upon himself. He is separated from his Father. But if we trust in him, it means that we can go free and the problem of sin is entirely dealt with. So any sins we've committed in the past, any sins we might be committing now, even sins that we might commit in the future, all of these are covered by Christ. He dies once and for all in our place. So it's a wonderful message that God does provide a way whereby we can escape the consequences of our sins.
Thank you very much, Adrian. This next question, do we deserve suffering?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's hard to answer, to be honest. I'll tell you why it's hard to answer. Doing this talk, and in fact being a Christian, would be a lot easier if, seeing as suffering does exist, if it could be proportionate. I mean, don't you think? It would be easier if, okay, let's say there has to be suffering because of the free will. Let's say we accept that for that point. You may not accept that point, but let's say for the sake of argument you did. It would be easier, wouldn't it, if those who lead the most selfish, the most awful, the most terrible lives are the ones that suffer most, and those people who lead a relatively good life compared to those other people, they suffer less. But in fact, that isn't what happens, and we see that suffering appears to be both arbitrary and random, which makes it even harder to get our heads around it. So the only way we can possibly think about this would be to say, if there is a loving God, then he might have what he considers to be morally sufficient reasons for allowing suffering, reasons that we wouldn't necessarily even understand. And could it also be, and this is a hard thing for us to accept, because if we were God, we would probably choose to maximize the greatest happiness of the greatest number of people on earth. So let's say I was God and I could make up the rules. I might decide to make conditions as good as possible for the greatest number of people. Maybe I'd have some trade-offs. Maybe I couldn't make everybody happy all the time. But I want the greatest number of people to be happy in this life. In Christianity, that isn't God's goal. God's goal is not to maximize human happiness in this life. God's goal is to create the environment that would result in the greatest number of people coming into faith and saving relationship with him, coming into a relationship with God. And so, now I know this is hard to even imagine. It could be that if there was less suffering in the world, or more suffering in the world than there is, that fewer people would come to trust in Christ, know God personally, go to heaven. It might be that God has set this amount of suffering, this suffering that we see today, because this is the ideal conditions for the greatest number of people to come into relationship with him. And it just so happens that at the present time, more people are becoming Christians all over the world than at any point in human history. And even more bizarrely, those who suffer most south of the equator are becoming Christians even faster than the birth rate in many parts of Africa, South America, and Asia.
Thank you. We'll have one more question before we break. Is God so weak that his only design for the world inevitably causes natural disasters and destroys life, or so cruel that he chooses this design?
Well, I think that's a very well-expressed question, and I think that touches the best objections to Christianity. And I'm aware that this is the last question that we're going to break, and then by all means, please stay, because if you can stay, we can carry on talking about this in more depth. I'm aware that I'm not going to do a good job on this. I think that question is best answered by the answer I just gave, that it might be that we don't have the full picture. It could be that God has morally sufficient reasons for allowing suffering that if we were in his shoes, we would agree with, but because we don't have his perspective, we don't. I totally accept that some people will not accept Christianity on that basis alone. They'll say, look, suffering is, there's too much, it's too extreme, it's too arbitrary, I need to walk away. All I would encourage you to do is, as you walk away, take a John's Gospel and read pages 50 to 55 and look at what Christians believe is a suffering God. At the very least, this God, who is weak and whatever else it was weak enough to suffer with us, was weak enough to be hung on a cross and complain like we do. Basically, God, where have you gone? I mean, have you ever said that? Where's God? My God, why have you forsaken me? A God who's weak enough to become human and to suffer with us. A God who can relate to what we're going through. But I totally accept the force of the question, and I accept this is a very, very strong objection. And just for the sake of the argument, I think that suffering is the best objection to the Christian faith.
I've heard some Christians say that there are natural disasters because we live in a fallen world. What does that mean?
Okay, I'll just repeat the questions. I've heard some Christians say that there are natural disasters because we live in a, quote, fallen world. What does that mean? Okay, within the New Testament part of the Bible, there's a letter written by Paul to the Romans where he does seem to be saying that this world isn't how God intended. And there are some verses in the Bible that suggest that when our first human parents sinned against God, that something happened beyond just humanity to affect the world in such a way that we now have disasters and things, tragedies and natural evil. On the other hand, it is also true that the more we discover about our planet, the more we discover it is minutely, finely tuned and adapted for human habitation. So not only is it true that the universe has to be as vast as it is, and as old as it is, in order for there to be the mineral deposits on Earth for us to have fossil fuels and have advanced civilized life, for example. Not only is it true that the conditions and laws of the universe have been fine-tuned so that humans can live on this planet, but we also find that even when we look at the systems, the weather systems, as I mentioned, plate tectonics, all of these things also are minutely finely adapted in such a way that makes human life possible. So it seems to me, if you'll forgive the analogy, that God has worked out a sort of a compromise, a bit like a laptop. Let me see if I can use a laptop as an illustration. A laptop is not the most powerful and effective computer you can get. You could get a bigger computer that could act faster, have more memory, and do more stuff. But the downside of that large computer would be portability. The beauty of a laptop or an iPad is the fact you can carry it around. And so essentially, your laptop or your iPad is a trade-off. It's a compromise. It's a compromise between speed and capacity and portability. I think that is what God has done with our planet. He hasn't created the biggest planet or you know, so on and so forth, but he's created a system that works, that enables us under the Earth's atmosphere with this kind of magnetic pull. He's put these massive gas giants like Jupiter in place to block us from the asteroids. He's set up this extremely complex system. We're in the bit of our, in the Milky Way, in between the Perseus and Sagittarius spiral arms, in the Goldilocks zone, the only place where life could exist. He's set the whole thing up to enable us to live on this planet. And so that would explain why our systems work so well. And it would also possibly explain, factoring in Romans 8, why you have, for example, sickness in the world, which is not part of God's original plan and is a result of human sin against God.
Thank you. Would someone from the floor like to come back on that? If not, we've got loads more questions we could move on to. Yes.
Hi, so let me just try and clarify my point, because I'm not quite deep. Are you basically saying that the way that the world is a way in which kind of maximizes utility in terms of God achieving God? So it's the best of the world.
Okay, this is a very good question from my right. Are you basically saying that God has created the best possible goal? Well, certainly in part of my answer, I was saying that God seems to achieve some fairly impressive systems that do enable human life to continue on the surface of the planet, systems that we would never have been able to dream up for ourselves. But on the other hand, I'm also saying that it is true in the Bible that we see that human decisions have had consequences, particularly in the case of sickness. So I'm saying both of those things are the case.
Thank you very much. What about suffering that has no benefit, like a girl who lives with a painful condition for 12 weeks after birth in excruciating pain, then died? Who does that benefit?
Yeah, this is a superb objection. And of course, being a Christian minister, I am confronted with this perhaps more often than most people. So one of the things that Christian ministers do is bury babies. So we're regularly coming into contact with the most appalling suffering. And sometimes people are even looking to you for some words of explanation, not just consolation. And it's very hard to answer such a question. As I think I said in the talk, I don't think there's any reason to think that in this life we will ever get an explanation for any particular act of suffering. I could mention some suffering that I've gone through, and I could then tell you I have absolutely no idea why it happened. There will be people who've suffered vastly more than me, who suffered for longer in apparently random, meaningless suffering, and there's absolutely no explanation why this particular person would have suffered. The Bible doesn't claim that in this life we will ever have an explanation. I totally accept that some people at this point may wish to walk away and say that's not good enough. I could never accept a religion that didn't provide me with an explanation for this particular act of suffering, this particular episode of suffering. What the Bible does provide you with is a suffering God, a God who cared enough to jump in, identify with suffering, and deal with the problem of sin, which means that we can go to heaven forever. So if that is true and we accept this message, then God would more than compensate for our suffering, which would be significant from the eternal perspective. But I totally accept in this life, you're looking at one particular person's suffering, there's no explanation. We just don't know.
Thank you very much. Would anyone like to come back on that from the floor? No. Why didn't God just create heaven then stop? If a heaven is possible for him to make, why make earth as well?
Well, thank you very much for whoever asked this question. I've been thinking about this quite a lot recently. Why wouldn't God just create heaven? Why go through this kind of slightly bizarre and painful transitionary stage of this world? I think the answer probably is that there will be a difference between people in this room who've trusted Christ and enjoy him forever in heaven and the angels. Remember, our question presupposes that God exists. Angels in heaven won't have any particular sense of having been forgiven for their sins. Yes, they may worship God, but they won't do that with any kind of sense that I shouldn't really be here. I don't really deserve this. God has been very kind to me, hasn't he? He forgave all my sins. But if we come to trust in Christ and we're forgiven our sins, then I suppose it's a bit like that marriage relationship I spoke about, where the whole thrill of it for me is that she chose me. And I would imagine the thrill of it for her is I chose her. So because we've made a free choice, that's what makes the relationship wholesome and enjoyable. Can I also say one other thing? And that is that perhaps another helpful way of thinking about this difficult question of suffering is that as a parent, every single day, I am asked by my four children are asking me to relieve their suffering, particularly my four-year-old. She considers that the sort of father figure in her life, the God figure in her life, which is effectively me, seeing as I make lots of decisions that affect her, that at the moment I'm being unjust towards her because at the moment I'm withholding from her a certain amount of sweets. She's allowed a certain amount of sweets, but she's not allowed everything that she wants. Now, I could, of course, say yes to all of my children's requests and demands all the time, and you may well think that would be more loving, particularly as I have the power to say yes to most of them, although not all of them. Now, if I did say yes to all of them, that would raise the question, would I really have their best interests at heart? They would very shortly have no teeth, because they would be eating so many sweets, their teeth would disintegrate. If I'm concerned about their dental hygiene, I will start to say no. Therefore, I'm allowing a certain amount of what they consider to be suffering because I have their best interests at heart. So it could be that I have their best interests at heart, but I am actually allowing suffering. Now, of course, they think, particularly Emma, my four-year-old, she thinks it's an injustice. And from her point of view, of course, it's absolutely true. It is an injustice. And I am denying her pleasure that she might legitimately have, but I've got reasons that she doesn't appreciate. I know that may not be a satisfying answer, but it might at least make sense to someone here, even if you don't like it, even if I don't like it, it may still be true.
Thank you, Adrian. What happens to people who suffer but have never heard about Jesus?
Well, the question of what about people who don't hear about Christ, there's a few things to say. First of all, for those of us in this room, I would hope that during the course of this week, either in this talk or possibly tomorrow or already this week or maybe tomorrow evening or this evening, you will have a chance to hear the good news about Jesus. I think those of us who've been in this event this lunchtime have heard something. So this is not a question for us, but it is a legitimate question about others. If it really is true that God has provided a way whereby people can come to know him personally if they come to hear about Christ, that's all well and good for those who hear about Christ because they could either accept him, in which case fantastic, or reject him. Well, at least that's their choice. But what about those who happen to live in a part of the world where they never get to hear the good news? Well, the Bible does not have any particular verse that directly addresses that particular question. The Bible's making the assumption that the Christians who've heard this good news will go and tell everybody all over the world. And so there isn't actually a verse that speaks to this. And so what we have to do is try and work out, okay, seeing as we don't have like the definitive answer, what have we got that is clear? And can we work from the clear to the obscure? And I'm going to suggest that the answer to this question is obscure. And I'm going to suggest that some things are clear. One thing that's clear is that the only way that people can get to heaven is because of Christ or through Christ. So somehow Christ is going to be the way. Then the question is, okay, what about those who've never heard? Isn't it the case that in the Old Testament, there are apparently some people such as Abraham who might never have heard the name Jesus, but because they had faith in God and they were responsive towards the revelation of God that they had faith in this God, and God saw that faith, and therefore they'll be in heaven. And if those people like Abraham will be in heaven, Abraham being the father of the Jewish nation, could it be that other people who haven't heard about Jesus, they could also get there? Answer, I don't know. Because I don't have a verse that kind of definitively says so. But what I do think is this. There are good reasons for thinking that as people respond to the light they have received, and if you're interested in this question, there's some discussion of it, I think, in Romans chapter 1 and Romans chapter 2 of the New Testament part of the Bible, that as people respond to the light they have received and the information they have heard about God, that God sends them more. And I recently came to think this is likely to be the case as a result of a visit to Newcastle, believe it or not. In Newcastle, I met a community of Iranian Christians, most of whom had come to faith in Christ without ever having met a Christian or ever come across a Bible. Living in Iran, a place where they were very unlikely to hear the Christian message, they had a series of dreams which seemed to point them towards Christ. One dream, for example, was of an individual who was in his dream. He was directed to go to a certain petrol station and wait there for somebody who looked a certain way. So he saw himself at a petrol station and this man coming out of a Jeep. A Christian missionary subsequently drove along the road, saw this man standing there, had this weird sense that he was supposed to stop. He walks over and says, I don't know why I've stopped. I'm supposed to talk to you. The man falls to his knees and said, 2 days ago, I was told to stand here at this petrol station that you would come. Do you have something to give me? Christian missionary goes to Jeep, produces Bible. The man is a Christian. So this is, you know, this is not a made up story. This is one we can validate. But there are lots of stories like that. In that case, at least, it seems to me we do maybe have God drawing people to himself, and as people respond to the revelation they have received, God sends them more. Eventually they hear the good news about Jesus and they can respond. So that's one possible way of understanding and making sense of this question.
Thank you. I'm really sorry we're not coming to the floor more, but we've got loads of questions and I'd really like to get through some of these. If free agency is a necessary component for genuine love, then what will be occurring in heaven? Can you sin in heaven?
Well, this is a good question because it suggests that in heaven our worship will not be entirely voluntary. I think that the Bible teaches that it will be entirely voluntary, that we will choose to worship in heaven. There is an interesting story in the New Testament which Jesus tells of a rich man and Lazarus, and this particular rich man doesn't make it to heaven. In fact, he's in what Jesus calls Hades. And he's sort of having a conversation. It's hard to envisage this. He's having a conversation with heaven. But it's clear from his attitude that he's continuing in rebellion against God. That even being separated from God in Hades or in hell, he's still rebelling and he's still saying no. Whereas you would think at that point he would change his mind. It could be that in the next life, those who choose to follow Christ will continue to do so. And that those who don't choose him will continue to not choose him. So that might be a way of understanding the next life.
Thank you. We've got a few questions on this topic, so apologies if I didn't quite ask yours. It's about free will. Some people are manufactured biologically, genetically, to have evil tendencies. Therefore, surely our free will is limited anyway, because we don't really have control over what we do.
Okay, I genuinely don't know whether it is the case that some people are manufactured biologically, genetically to have evil tendencies. That may well be the case. I'm just going to plead ignorance and say that I don't have enough knowledge in that area to say whether or not that is the case. Is there free will therefore limited as a result? Well, I would certainly say there are some absolutely spectacular examples of deeply, quotes, evil people who, having heard the Christian message, have turned to Christ. So I don't think it can be an absolute barrier. But let's say I accept the premise of the question, particularly given my ignorance, that there are some people in this situation, it would still be possible for them to turn to Christ. And Christianity, the story of the Christian church, is a narrative of surprising conversions. There are a host of villains who've trusted in Christ. In fact, in these question and answer sessions, I'm more often asked, how can God possibly be gracious and merciful if he is allowing murderers and so on, if they repent and turn to Christ, into heaven? So the opposite objection is often raised. I think it's a really good question. I don't think I've answered that. It could well be, whoever you are, if you come and see me at the end, I may be able to find one of the team here who knows something about that and can do a better job than I just did.
Thank you very much. If Jesus was God, this is with reference to you saying that Jesus cried out to his Father. If Jesus was God, how could he not understand or know why the things he suffered were happening? Surely he could have predicted it, understood it in a way that we can't. Surely his suffering was different to ours.
Well, this is a really good question. And when I read the Bible, I'm thinking what you're asking. Shall I tell you why? Because just before this episode on the cross, where he dies on the cross and he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's in the Garden of Gethsemane and he's weighing up whether or not he's going to go through with the cross. He's dropping beads of blood and sweat are coming from his brow. He seems to be fully aware of the suffering that's coming, not just the physical suffering. When he talks about this cup of suffering that God's going to ask him to drink, he seems to be fully aware it's not only going to hurt, but it's also going to be spiritual isolation and desolation. And he says, yes. This is the point where he could have bailed. And if you watch Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of the Christ, at this point, the devil is literally egging him on. The devil's standing right there in The Passion of the Christ, sort of dramatizing the incident that isn't actually in the Bible, but I'm just giving you a bit of sort of dramatic license here. In the Bible, it's clear that at the Garden of Gethsemane, Christ does make a decision to go through with the cross, fully aware of what's coming. But then when he's actually there, he does appear to be overwhelmed by the desolation, and he cries out in agony. And I can only imagine that that's his humanity. I mean, this is an extraordinary idea that he was fully man and fully God. And so sometimes he's doing things you think, my goodness, this person must be God. And other times, like when he's on the cross, you think, well, yeah, he was actually a human being as well. Now, personally, I feel more drawn to Christ because of that vulnerability, because I see, oh, this is a real human. He can relate to what I'm going through. Because if Jesus just literally sails through life, oh, today I'm being crucified, no big deal, this is all part of God's plan, no problem, yeah, it's going to hurt, but hey, I'm God, it doesn't matter. I'm kind of like, does that really help? Does someone acing life really help me that much? But if I do see a suffering God, I can at least relate to that. So I personally find it helpful that even Jesus struggled with this question of suffering.
Thank you very much. To finish off with, we have a question about hell, which is a topic you're going to be talking about on Friday. So can I encourage you, if this is your question and you're able to come back on Friday, it might be really helpful to come along then. But just for people who maybe can't come on Friday, why would God torture us in hell if he loves us? Maybe just a headline answer.
Well, I would question the premise of the question. I would question the torturing because I'm not quite sure what's envisaged in that word. I think that when it comes to the question of hell, if it is true that those who choose Christ do so freely, if it's also true that those who choose a path away from God do so freely, it would seem that eternalizing those decisions would be the most natural thing. And so if someone spends eternity without God, let's imagine they didn't want to have anything to do with the Christian God in this life, presumably it would be immoral for God to then railroad that person and send them to heaven when all through their life they've said, that is the one thing that I don't want. I would have thought that would turn God into an eternal kidnapper who forces people who chose to be without him to be with him forever. So I don't think sending everybody to heaven would be the answer. And as to whether God is torturing people eternally in hell, I would have to say that we're going to get into all of that in quite a lot of detail in the talk on Friday. Thank you.